Finding Our Way is proudly supported by Berghaus, who are committed to sharing their passion for the outdoors with people from all backgrounds. Just a heads up, this episode involves a conversation about stigma and mental health, losing a friend to suicide, and living with and managing self-harm and suicidal thoughts. There are no details of the specific events. For more detailed information, have a look at the episode description.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Our Way, the new podcast from the British Mountaineering Council, otherwise known as the BMC. I'm Cress Allward.
And I'm Marianne O'Hotter. This podcast is all about diversifying the voices we normally hear talking about the outdoors. So in each episode, we'll be chatting to someone who's usually busy climbing, mountaineering or walking
to find out what they love, what they hate, the highs and lows of their journey so far, and what insights they can share with us to make the world a better place. Expect good chat, memorable stories, and hopefully bursts of inspiration from people who are making real change happen.
So, Cress, who have we got today?
Joining us today is a man who's not afraid to challenge the status quo outdoors or undertake daunting journeys overseas. Someone who positively encourages difficult and deeply honest conversations, relentlessly challenging stigmas around mental well-being that cause so many to suffer in silence. He's an experienced expedition leader, a provider of mental health first aid courses, and the founder of a charity called Changing Horizons. He believes everyone has the right to a good quality of life and that conversations are the catalyst for change. Connecting with us from Dorset, welcome, Stu Skinner.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me today.
Thanks for joining us on Finding Our Way.
So, Stu, tell us a bit about yourself.
My name's Stu, obviously. I'm a director of a small mental health charity called Changing Horizons. I'm also a freelance expedition leader who's passionate about the mental health benefits of outdoor activity and kind of making a link between kind of the mental health world and that of the outdoor world.
What triggered your interest in the outdoors and your interest in mental health education?
The outdoors really came from my mental health journey. From the age of 14, I wanted to be an ambassador. I dreamt of being an ambassador. I wanted to work in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. And then I went to the US when I was 19 years old, and I went through a very traumatic experience, which really impacted on me. And I went through things that I'd never experienced before. I thought things, had feelings that I'd never experienced. And I really didn't understand what I was going through. And I guess, you know, what I now know is a mental health challenge, which, you know, developed into a mental health diagnosis, and really struggled with self-harm and suicidal thoughts. And ultimately, I made an attempt on my life. Was very lucky to survive that suicide attempt. There was this descent into, you know, deep struggles with my mental health and my well-being. And I never really got the support I guess I needed. I didn't get a diagnosis till much later after I left university. And, you know, once I received that diagnosis, it was a diagnosis of bipolar disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, I was told that there was no career in the Foreign Office for me.
Because of that, because of the diagnosis?
Because of the diagnosis and I guess the experiences I've been through, yeah. It was made pretty clear to me.
Wow. What was the impact of being told that?
Deeply distressing, and I guess there was part of me that maybe realised, you know, that a career in the Foreign Office probably wasn't appropriate for me, maybe anyway, but, you know, mental illness at that point, it had then robbed me of my career. It robbed me of, you know, my relationship. It robbed me of a home and my hopes and dreams. And I just thought that was like a closed door. And at the age of 25, I thought my life was over. I thought there was no coming back. I couldn't see a future for myself. And I guess that's when that feelings of hopelessness and despair and I guess suicidal thoughts really set in, because I was just like, well, what's the point? What am I going to do with myself? And I just didn't know. And I couldn't see past, I guess, my illness and my personal struggles.
Stuart, sounds like there was very little support back then. Did you go to a doctor?
I did. And the support, I didn't really get much support. You know, when I spoke to my university professor about my feelings and my suicidal thoughts, given that I also lost my best friend at the age of 21 to suicide, you know, he just put down my feelings. He's just like, you know, they're just exam nerves. Everyone has exam nerves. You know, you'll be fine. And that was just constantly be told, you know, you'll be fine. And, you know, what have you got to be depressed about? You know, you've got good friends, good family, a good life. So there just wasn't really, I guess, a lot of support at that time. And I guess a lot of the support out there wasn't that really, really helpful. But I guess there was also a part on my place and maybe some individual accountability. But I think this is the problem with stigma is I didn't want to accept that I had a mental illness. And it's very hard to get help and get better unless you're prepared to accept that you know you do have a challenge or an illness, and that took a long time for me, I guess, to accept.
Do you think those unhelpful responses, do they come from a place where people are effectively well-intentioned but ignorant, or is it something more harmful, more sinister, if you will?
I mean, I guess some of it was, you know, sinister, and I guess, you know, I always want to kind of focus on the positives, and, you know, I've led an incredible life and, you know, a richly rewarding life that probably wouldn't have happened had I not gone through these experiences. But, you know, when I spoke to my GP and said, you know, I'm struggling with self-harm, and she said, you're clearly an intelligent person. Why are you doing something so stupid? I mean, I don't know if that comes, I don't know if that comes from a place of ignorance or that's really sinister. And, you know, thankfully, you know, that was over 20 years ago, and I went on to have an incredible relationship with a very helpful GP. I see a counsellor who has just done wonders for my mental health. I get psychiatrist, and, you know, it took a long time for me to find out how to access these services. And there's a lot of helpful, supportive people out there, but unfortunately there's still a lot of people who, whether through ignorance or prejudice, kind of still buy into that stigma and, I guess, reinforce those beliefs that are massively unhelpful for people who are experiencing mental health challenges. I got into the outdoors because I joined a friend on a 4,500-mile bike trip through Southeast Asia, and which proved to be, I guess, the catalyst for change.
That's quite a first journey. Did you literally go from sort of nothing to a 4,000-mile bike ride?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I barely left the house for about 16 months. Really struggled with social anxiety and just being around people and depression. You know, became very introverted, where once I was, you know, very extroverted and very confident. And, you know, I was massively into my sports. So I've always loved sports. I played American football at university. And, yeah, just a friend said, look, you know, dude, I know you're going through a really difficult time. How about you come join me on this journey? And it's just, that was kind of like the light that I needed, because, you know, there was no light. I couldn't see a future. There was no hope in my life. And I went to work for the first time in a long time. I deliberately worked in a coffee shop because that would make me kind of get over or help me manage my social anxiety and make me, you know, have conversations with people. I flew to the Philippines. I didn't even own a bike, didn't do any training, just bought a secondhand bike when I got out there and just winged it, basically. It was a proper adventure and a massive step into the unknown.
Wow, that's so courageous. Tell us about how things changed when you were on that big bike ride and when you've been on expeditions since then.
I mean, it was massively transformational. That's like almost like the next chapter, like, you know, the middle section of, I guess, my life story. If, you know, if I was to break my life up, and I think, you know, where there was only, like, I guess, despair, that, you know, I suddenly found hope. I found my passion again. I found my zest for life. I found purpose. You know, every day brought something new. Every day brought adventure. And I had all these incredible experiences and these interactions with, you know, people I probably, you know, would never have met. And these, you know, these human connections. And yeah, I can't begin to describe the change within me. And it's like suddenly I wanted to live again. And suddenly I saw a future for myself. And it was something I'll never forget, you know, and will be always eternally grateful for my friend for asking me to join him on that trip, because it changed my life and it saved my life as well.
Wow.
Is that where your, this passion from expeditioning stems from, Stu? Did you go on to do more training after that trip?
I mean, because I came back from that trip and then I was like, well, what next? I mean, that's a question that people often ask you when you undertake big journeys. Well, what's next? And I didn't really know. I knew that the career that I wanted had gone, so I had to kind of find something new. And I heard about this career, this job, an expedition leader, basically. So I looked into it. And I thought that would be amazing, to facilitate, the experience I had on this bike trip for other people. It sounded perfect, to transform kind of all those negative experiences into something positive. And then I found out there was a 6-month expedition leader training course. So I signed up on that and went to the Welsh mountains for a month, which was, quite shocking. I hadn't had any experience of the British outdoors before, really, except for kind of being stood out on the wing on a rugby pitch, getting slightly cold. But I can remember going into the mountains dressed for the jungle and, dressed in cotton and kind of looked at like I was bonkers, to be fair, to kind of use some of that language. I guess I wanted to become comfortable in the Welsh mountains. That's my thing. Because I was deeply uncomfortable, very much out of my depth, and I'd never used a compass before and never come across, fog, and it was just all these new skills. And I guess every time I learned something new or I accomplished something new, that really helped build up my self-esteem and self-worth, which I guess for many people like myself who live with mental health conditions or challenges, it tends to rob of us of that at times. So it was a great experience.
So then what did you do with your expedition training?
So we spent 1 month in the Welsh mountains, did our mountain leader training, and then we went to Belize for 6 months. And I guess there were four of us doing this expedition leader training. And then we kind of became staff assistants on a gap year expedition. I think there were 24, 19 to 26 year olds. And we went on a remote jungle expedition. And when I mean remote, it was remote, so we trekked all our food in, we bathed in rivers, everything we cooked off was on fires, we built, our own latrines and, completely shut off, no electricity. So it was it was like an incredible experience, something that I'd never encountered before.
I can resonate with that, having led an overseas expedition with Valley International. It's quite challenging, isn't it? And throws up various aspects because people are very much out of their comfort zone. How did you experience that?
The jungle, I'd say, is one of the most challenging environments, to work in. It can be very claustrophobic. Everything is out to eat you, bite you, sting you. and it's hot and you're sweaty all the time. And, there were no home comforts, taking away, all these home comforts from people. And in some ways that was great because, we all, that's how I think communities are formed, aren't they? Going through this shared reference, we were all going through the same thing. We built this incredible community, but also, those challenges, I guess, did impact on our well-being to a certain extent because it's nice to sleep in a nice bed sometimes. It's nice to have a home cooked meal. It's quite nice to watch a film from time to time. But definitely I wasn't really prepared for the mental health challenges. I knew it would be a physical challenge, but I really wasn't prepared for the mental health challenges of the expedition.
And do you mean your own and your other, the fellow leaders, or do you mean the participants?
I mean, we all definitely experienced it at some points. We ended up getting beef worms, bot flies, kind of larva that's like living in your body, kind of eating away, like I said. And it was definitely challenging. And I think this is, some people were really impacted and really affected by the jungle in terms of their mental health. But if you think about preparation and briefings and as expedition leader, I'm sure Cress can testify this, we always talk about, physical health and safety. We talk about the environment. We talk about drinking water. We talk about putting sunscreen on and taking your malaria tablets and, putting talc on your feet and making sure your feet are dry at the end of the day. But, there was never kind of any briefings around, what can you do to look after your mental health? How to manage the mental health hazards and challenges of the jungle. And I guess it was unsurprising, when you're away from your home comfort, that's away from your support network for 3 months with no comforts, that it threw up a lot of mental health challenges. And some of the young people really did struggle with their mental health, to the point where some people, or one person, was experiencing suicidal thoughts. And, You know, there was feelings of self-harm, panic attacks, and, you know, sleeplessness. It was, like I said, it threw a lot at us, really.
Did you feel qualified to deal with that, to help them? Or were you kind of in at the deep end going, oh, I don't know what to do about this?
I guess it was kind of left to me to manage people's or support people with their mental health, because I've been through this journey and I was very open about that. And no one really knew what to do. The other staff assistants didn't really know what to do. The expedition leader, you know, by his own admission, was a little bit out of his depth, even though he's an incredibly, you know, caring and empathetic individual. And suddenly it felt like, you know, everyone would come to me to talk about, you know, the issue, the struggles. And I guess I felt, you know, kind of out of my depth at times. And I was kind of happy to do that to some extent, but I didn't really have, you know, the proper toolkit, and it was kind of making things up as I went along. And I guess all I could really offer was an empathetic ear. And I guess it's, you know, when I, it kind of really baffled me, I'd had all this first aid training and that, you know, someone was bitten by a snake and, you know, all our first aid training kicked in and we knew exactly what to do and there was no panic. It was, you know, very systematic and we got the person the help they needed, you know, scorpion stings. But when it came to mental health, you know, like everyone was out their depth. And I was just like, well, why don't we have mental health first aid? Why isn't there a first aid equivalent for mental health if we need to support people with their physical health and physical injuries? You know, why isn't there a mental health equivalent?
And thinking about all the years, I mean, I've been leading expeditions for 20 years, probably similar to you, Stu. And yeah, I'm just laughing now and looking back and going, all those people overseas, of course they're going to be out of their comfort zone. Of course they're going to be loads of issues. It would be just so naive. And yet it just wasn't a thing, was it? It was just like, oh, either man up or, you know, those sorts of really helpful expressions, or you'll just get on with it. Classic British outlook, I guess, old school. So tell us about how you've managed to get your mental health first aid courses into the outdoors. That's no mean feat, Stu, is it?
I guess it was a massive undertaking. I became a certified mental health first aider back in 2010. And that's when immediately I started to drive it or try to drive it in the outdoor industry. And I knocked on a lot of people's doors and I managed to get funding to run, you know, fully funded courses. And people seemed to get a lot from the course and would like it. But still, there was a lot of reluctance and hesitancy around it. And, you know, I was an expedition leader for World Challenge. And I was, you know, constantly just say, hey guys, you know, I run this mental health first aid course. And eventually we got there. And I think, you know, to be honest, you know, they made a very bold and brave step to make mental health first aid mandatory for all their expedition leaders, which I think, you know, it's incredible, not just, you know, for the benefits of the training, but to make that statement that we take mental health as seriously as physical health. We believe that all young people should, you know, have their mental health supported on expeditions, and we want to make expeditions more inclusive for young people.
Do you think the resistance from organisations in the industry was because, oh, that, you know, that old fashioned thought of, oh, well, if you're a bit weak minded, then you probably shouldn't be on an expedition anyway? I use that term with inverted commas.
I think, you know, there's the idea that perhaps maybe that we're pampering to people if we start talking about feelings and emotions, and that, you know, we should, you know, definitely most buckle up and, you know, just get on with it. And but also I think it's just, you know, people didn't really recognize the importance of this training, or perhaps didn't know enough about it, or even want to know enough about it to see how it could help, and it could help leaders support young people with their mental health and help them manage crises that have, I'm sure, you know, Cress and I both had to manage mental health crises as we had physical health crises. So it was difficult for me to understand because I'm really passionate about it and I see the value. And I guess I got frustrated and struggled to understand why people maybe are so reluctant to it and are still very reluctant to it. And I think it's also because, you know, let's face it, mental health still scares a lot of people. and that's part of the stigma. You know, words like psychosis and schizo and all this unhelpful language kind of reinforces this idea that people with mental illness or mental health conditions are unstable or scary or crazy, and that's simply not true. And also, you know, I think we're not very, I guess it, maybe it goes back to British, we don't like having uncomfortable conversations, do we? We just like to put them to one side and, you know, just gloss over things, really. So I think there was just a lot of fear about having conversations about mental health. And also maybe I think a lot of people are quite scared about going on these training because they have to look inside themselves, don't they? They have to maybe take a look at themselves and kind of recognise that maybe, or realise that they've been through their own mental health journey, because we all have to some extent, haven't we?
Absolutely. And I think, Stu, going back as well, just, you know, mentally flicking through my mind, for many, many years, all the training for expedition leaders, certainly if you wanted to lead a trip overseas, was all about technical expertise and pretty much nothing else. Whereas nowadays, certainly mountain training, I know, are far more open and understand that to be an effective leader, yes, you might need the technical qualifications. We all need those. That's not in doubt. But actually, you need to be able to empathise. You need to be a great people person because you are with people 24/7 in often extreme environments. So you need to know how to handle people when they're, you know, not at their best. And no technical expertise will give you those skills.
Are those skills that you can learn, or are they? Is that just a kind of person specification? Either you are a kind of good people person that people can feel confidence in turning to you if they're struggling, or is that something that someone says, oh, I'm really good at climbing up mountains and doing rope work and dealing with scorpion stings, but I'm not great with, you know, people who are crying. Can they fix that? Is that something, I mean, can they come on a course with you, Stu, and you'll set them straight?
I would say, yeah, I mean, you know, obviously some people are naturally empathetic, aren't they? And some people, you know, like as people, you know, we're all very different and we've all had very different life experiences, which really influences how we respond to situations and how we manage people. But, you know, I most definitely believe, you know, that empathy is a trait, but it's also a skill. You know, you can learn empathy, and there's even something that exists called, you know, the empathetic formula. And for me, it's really not that difficult. You know, supporting someone with their mental health isn't that difficult. For me, it starts with a question. Just want to check in with you. Is everything okay? Or I'm really worried about you, mate. And if all you say is that sounds really difficult when someone's open up, or that sounds very painful, or that's rubbish, and then just say, tell me more, or go on. If that's all you say, then you're going to support with someone with their mental health. You're going to make them feel valued and validated, and like it will de-escalate, you know, it kind of can bring them down to more centered place and make them feel heard. And that's a really supportive thing that you can do for a person. And anyone can do that. Anyone can start a conversation. And so, yeah, I don't think you need to have all those soft skills. You just need to be, I guess just recognize when someone might be going through a difficult time and starting the conversation and just letting them know that you care, because that's how we do support someone.
I guess from the questions that you just sort of demonstrated, none of those questions were solution focused or judgmental. They were all about listening.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds quite simplistic, but for me, you know, to go back to first aid, for me, that's really like the bandaging of mental health first aid, you know, going to first aid. And that's how we create a supportive environment. That's how we can de-escalate a mental health crisis. And it's incredible how powerful listening is. You know, there's a reason why the Samaritans save thousands of lives every year. You know, they're not trained counsellors. They're volunteers who are trained to listen. And, you know, all of us, I guess, all of us could learn how to listen a little bit better, and that, you know, all of us could improve our listening skills most definitely.
Can you tell us about this empathetic formula you mentioned?
It's a very simple formula. So it starts off with a tentifier. So using something like it seems like, or I wonder if, or what I'm hearing is, it sounds like. And then you want to use a strong feeling word to kind of really validate their feelings. And we were encouraged to kind of use like really strong, like powerful words. So someone said if they're feeling scared, then we'd say maybe feeling terrified or feeling anguished, or that sounds very painful. And then you want to identify the source of the feeling. It's maybe because it's they're being isolated, or, you know, there's no connection with friends because of the pandemic, or they've gone through a bereavement, or they've been made redundant. So, you know, it sounds like you're feeling really anxious because you've been made redundant and you're unsure if you're going to be able to get a job in the current climate. So that very simply and simplistic is the empathetic response formula, you know. So it's very powerful. And I'd say my girlfriend, you know, who I loved a bit, she's probably not the most naturally empathetic person, but, you know, I think she's really learned the power of using the empathetic response formula, and it's definitely, you know, helped our relationship, and I'd say it's helped her relationship with her friends. So I definitely believe empathy can be learned, and it's quite a simple and easy formula to kind of remember and use, really.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that resonates for me, because I suspect maybe I'm a bit like your girlfriend. I feel like I'd go, oh, well, why don't you do this? Or, oh, it might be okay. You know, lots of people. And that's so unhelpful. I mean, I've got to the point in my own personal journey to realise that's not helpful. But sometimes I say it and then go, oh, I shouldn't have said that. Mm.
Expedition leaders, you know, they do try, you know, sit down and tell me how you feel and try to fix that person. Mm. And that's not really supportive, and it's not really helpful. And I guess rarely does an empathetic response start with at least, or, you know, things always better, or, you know, why don't, you know, think about people who've got it worse off than you, which is, yeah, it's not going to make anyone feel heard, listened to, or valued. And I also think, you know, silence is incredibly supportive. Just sitting with someone, not saying anything, is also really powerful and very supportive.
Do you think that perhaps some of the reticence to address issues is related to, I'm really wary, but I'm going to ask, gender, and that many men may not have had role models where, or feel comfortable where they, you know, they feel safe to talk about feelings. So do you think there's a, that plays a part?
Massively. I mean, you know, growing up as someone who played a lot of football and rugby, you know, we were, you know, taught if we got hurt on the pitch to get back up, otherwise, you know, we were being a girl, and, you know, big boys don't cry, and kind of emasculated, you know, like that's not what men do. And, you know, and I guess I really, it's something I'm really kind of like passionate about challenging, and kind of making people aware of how detrimental and the impact, you know, like, I don't think it was depression that killed my best mate. I don't think that's what drove him to suicide. It might have given him suicidal thoughts and feelings, but words like man up, and, you know, big boys don't cry, kind of that idea that you're less of a man because you're experiencing, you know, emotional and mental health difficulties, because that stopped him from speaking to me, stopped him from speaking to his best friend about the emotional challenges he was going through. It stopped me from speaking to my best mate. But, you know, like, I just, yeah, it's very difficult because I can look back and then go, just imagine if we both felt safe and able to say, this is what I'm going through. He would still be alive, and, you know, I probably wouldn't have attempted suicide. And so, yeah, that kind of idea that, you know, mental health challenges is just something, you know, we can click our fingers and get over it, or look over at the bright side. It's not true, and it's not helpful, and it definitely plays a part in why, you know, suicide is the leading cause of death for men under the age of 50.
There's been a lot of talk about mental health, and, you know, there's royal support for mental health foundations, and people, I get the sense that particularly during lockdown, people have felt to some extent more able to talk about finding things difficult and having difficult feelings. But do you think that are aspects that we're ignoring in the kind of the narrative that is going on in society at the minute?
I think one silver lining of the pandemic is that suddenly everyone is aware of this thing, mental health, you know, people talking about mental health. I think a lot of people, you know, I ask the question, what is mental health? What does mental health mean to you? And still a lot of people think, you know, mental health is something that they have, you know, people with problems and anxiety and depression. And I think, Sunny, you know, a lot of things, we do a lot of things to maintain and manage our our mental health, things we took for granted, or maybe we did subconsciously. And then the pandemic came along, lockdown came along, and these things were taken away from us. And suddenly people's mental health were affected and impacted. And they sort of realized, okay, so the reason why I went for a walk by the river is because, you know, I was doing that because it's really good for my emotional and mental health well-being. The reason why I stay connected and see my friends and family, because that's good for my mental health and emotional well-being. So I definitely think there's a lot we've learned about it, but I'm still unsure as to whether we as a society or, you know, a people are still okay to talk about mental health, whether they're still okay to start a conversation. And when they ask some, you know, someone, you know, how are you doing, mate? Where they're actually asking, you know, how are you doing? And really wanting to know how that person is doing rather than just a kind of, you know, like a greeting, which is, you know, you're right, mate? Yeah, I'm all right, mate. Yeah. You know, that's how a lot of the conversations go. So I guess...
No, I'm not all right. Whoa, I don't want to know that.
Yeah, exactly. I still don't think... Exactly. I still don't think we're quite prepared for that. Well, actually, I'm feeling pretty rubbish, mate. I think that still scares us. I think that still needs changing. And you know, that's okay. It's okay for people to feel that way because we haven't had any real education or training or emotional literacy. You know, it still baffles me that we had physical education at school and sex education at school. We had no kind of mental health education or emotional literacy. So it's no wonder that we're afraid of these conversations because we're just not used to having them. And that's why I just think it's so important that we normalise them. And it's great that the Royals and, you know, professional football players and certain celebrities are doing great work around this. But I think there needs to be more work on just the, you know, the general population having these conversations, and let's hearing stories of success of the general public. You know, let's hear more real stories, I guess, as well. I definitely know from having lots of conversations with people, you know, well, what stops you from having a conversation about mental health? And I think people are so afraid of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing that they just do nothing. And, you know, just even a simple question, like, you know, even about the weather or what you did last night, that can be enough to change a person's life. And just asking a simple question like, you know, is everything okay? You know, I'm really worried about you and I just want to know, you know, how you're doing. That can, you know, start someone on a journey to recovery and can possibly change their life. And, you know, you don't have to have the answers. You don't need to have the solutions. It really is about listening, asking open-ended questions and just giving that person to share whatever they feel comfortable sharing and not trying to fix them.
You went to Egypt recently. I'm just going to change tack slightly. Tell us about that.
I think like many people, you know, my mental health really was impacted by, you know, the pandemic. From I worked so hard to establish my charity and things were going so well. And then this thing came along and it kind of knocked everything down again. And, you know, I lost a lot of work and I was just I went to a dark place. And, you know, for me, I live with suicidal thoughts. So something I had to manage on a daily basis. Most of the time I could ignore them. I can put them to one side, but, you know, in a third floor apartment with no garden and just being here on my own, things kind of escalated and I got lost in my thoughts. And I recognized that I needed to do something because I didn't want to go back to that place I've been before. And for me, you know, the outdoors has become, I guess it's my sanctuary. It's been hugely instrumental in my recovery and how I manage my mental health. And there's this, yeah, an incredible individual who's been creating all these trails out in Egypt. So I just gave him a message and just said, I want to come to Egypt. I want to hike a trail. And he said, well, actually, we just created this new trail called the Seven Summits Sinai Trail, which is a 180-kilometer trail taking in seven of the biggest summits in the Sinai region. Do you want to do it? And I was like, much like the bike trip, I was like, yes, that sounds perfect for me. So just flew out to Egypt, spent some time with him, and I just undertook this undertaking just in the remote Sinai desert with my Bedouin guide and camels.
Wow. Oh,
sounds great.
When you make that decision for that radical shift to go on an expedition, something fully committing that takes you away from where you were before, do you sometimes worry that actually won't be the kind of the magic balm to give you space to kind of breathe and recover to some extent? Or do you go, I know this is going to work for me?
I guess, you know, for me, it wasn't about going away, you know, like people asking me, like, you know, you're going away from it all, so you're just trying to get away, you're trying to escape. And for me, it was about going back to it all, you know, going back to what's important, going back to where we're from, because we're of this world, aren't we? We're not of social media and being bombarded with news and Brexit and Trump and the pandemic. So for me, it was about reconnecting to Mother Earth and Mother Nature and being in the outdoors and seeing the stars in the skies and not being connected 24 hours a day, not being, you know, worrying what's going on in the world and spending time, you know, with the Bedouin and living that simple, slow pace of life where, you know, every time we met someone, it didn't matter if we had, you know, another 18K or 1K to do, we would sit down and we'd make tea and they'd sit and chat and I'd just get my book out and read. And for me, I know that going into the outdoors and disconnecting and, you know, being a bit, you know, in Mother Nature, it's deeply helpful for my mental health because it gives me space to think. It gives me clarity. It helps me better understand my thoughts and feelings. And I find stillness and peace that I don't necessarily always kind of feel in this world that we've kind of now created for ourselves.
Tell us a bit more about your charity, Changing Horizons.
The charity, I guess, predominantly runs mental health courses, whether that be mental health first aid courses or shorter mental health awareness courses. Lots of the courses I'm running now is about how to have a conversation about mental health. So how to start a conversation, how to manage that conversation and kind of, you know, what next, what signposting is out there, what help is available for that person. So kind of debunking the fear around having conversations about mental health. I work with organisations like Burberry and currently working with Dyson. So it's, you know, quite a varied mix of clients, but still my passion is always for the outdoors and still my passion and I guess my ultimate aim is to make wherever, I guess, someone has to have a first aid qualification, that they should also have a mental health first aid qualification, that, you know, mental health first aid should be as, you know, we should have as many mental health firsts as we do first aiders, because I truly believe that there's still a disparity between how we see physical health and how we see mental health, and I guess I want to address that imbalance. I'd like to think we're getting there. I mean, we're having this conversation now, aren't we?
So, Stu, what's been your highlight so far in this incredible career of yours to date?
For me, the highlight has most definitely been World Challenge saying, right, Stu, we're going to make mental health first aid mandatory for all our expedition leaders. And in that process, I trained over 370 expedition leaders and operational staff in mental health first aid in about an 18-month period, and that was in its own right an incredible journey and an incredible adventure, which I got to have open conversations with some truly inspiring and amazing individuals who, to be honest, had not always had the space to talk about their own mental health, and it was great to have these conversations.
Do you think things are changing? That perception that the expedition leader is the kind of superhero at the front, you know, carrying the biggest pack, hacking through the jungle, shows no fear, shows no weakness. Is that changing, or are we still living with that stereotype? I guess it's a question to you, Cress, as well, because you're an expedition leader as well as Stu.
I think there's probably still a way to go. And there's probably a difference for males and females, I would imagine. I think for some people, talking about feelings is pretty terrifying. Yeah, so we just have to normalise it, as Stu says.
Stu, what do you think? Are we still living with the spectre of the superhero?
I think that was definitely the notion and kind of my understanding idea of what I should be, and then it didn't take me very long to kind of realize that that was deeply unhelpful for myself, but also was doing a disservice to the people in my group. And I think we are starting to recognize the importance of soft skills and the power of vulnerability, that there's courage and strength in being vulnerable and showing your whole true self and not having to kind of wear this mask. And I think more people are starting to recognize and realize that. And I also think, you know, I think young people are challenging adults to kind of be that person as well, because I think definitely young people are kind of embracing mental health and well-being. So I think we have to adapt if we are to support young people.
It seems really startling to me, Stu, that there are so many outdoor organisations that are promoting the benefits and the well-being and mental health benefits of being outdoors, and yet they seem slow to embrace the importance of mental health first aid training.
I mean, I think that is, you know, the stark contrast in the outdoor industry. You know, we're very good at promoting the mental health benefits of outdoor activity, and adventure providers are very good at promoting the well-being benefits of what they provide. But, you know, the contrast is they do very little to train people, to support people when they access those services or when they're in the outdoors. So, again, you know, I think that's something that needs to change.
Missed opportunity. Yeah. A missed responsibility, if anything.
But the good news is that we can do something with this and we can take it forward. And we will.
Yeah, listeners, that's on you as well.
And they need to, like, you know, I don't think, you know, and I believe the outdoors has a hugely instrumental part in kind of healing the trauma of what people have gone through. And for many people, this last year has been traumatic. And I do think outdoors and adventure can play a pivotal part in healing that trauma. So we need to be prepared. We need to know how to support people with their mental health, you know, because people have been so affected in this last year.
If someone is listening to this podcast and they're going, "Ooh, mental health first aid course, I've heard about that and this sounds intriguing and Stu sounds like a good bloke," what is it that they would expect? What's it going to be like if they sign up for a course?
It really is, you know, a first aid approach to mental health. So it's kind of not, you know, it's not about being a psychiatrist, psychotherapist or counsellor. It's not about diagnosing people. It's just kind of about, you know, recognizing those early warning signs. So if we see someone, you know, signs or symptoms of distress, if we see someone's in crisis, but as I'm always keen to stress, it's, you know, trust your instinct. I think we know if something's not quite right or if something's not up. And then we provide that help on an initial basis, you know, so try and de-escalate the crisis or try and create a supportive environment to help that person kind of manage their emotions, process their thoughts and feelings, and then guide them to more appropriate professional help. And I guess you learn about what help's available out there and how listening and active listening creates a supportive environment and can de-escalate a mental health crisis. And like I said, it's really not about kind of diagnosing or kind of learning loads of information about mental illness and schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. It really is about, you know, preserving a life where ultimately where someone's at risk to themselves and, you know, learning how to have conversations about suicide and ultimately how to save a life when it comes to a person's mental health, because I can't stress this enough, a conversation can not only start on a journey to recovery, it can also save someone's life. Recovery, not only is it possible, it's more than probable these days because there's so much effective treatment out there. There's a plethora of support. There's so many places, organisations and individuals where we can get help. And it's, I just think more people need to know that.
So, Stu, if we have listeners out there who want to do something positive, they may be a bit concerned about a friend or family member, what can they do?
I would just say, you know, check in that person and try and start an honest, authentic conversation and really ask that person how they're feeling. And if they, you know, just say fine or I'm okay or, doing all right, just to ask twice and let them know that you're actually asking how they're doing.
What's next? What does the future look like?
I'm really focusing on normalising conversations about suicidal thoughts and feelings. You know, one in five people experience suicidal thoughts at some point in their lives. And, you know, we've been talking about this pandemic and, you know, and the lives that have been lost to that. But, you know, with suicide, every single life is preventable. And for me, it's so important that, you know, more people feel comfortable having these uncomfortable conversations and creating a world, a society where people feel safe to open up about how they're feeling, because, you know, we can't always spot the signs. We can't always spot the symptoms. You know, people are very good at wearing their masks. So it has to kind of be a two-way thing. So I guess I also want to help create a world where there is no stigma. There are no barriers. So people feel safe to share how they feel and don't feel like they need to hide a part of themselves just to so that they're not a burden or to not worry people.
It's important work. Thank you for doing it. It sounds also quite emotionally exhausting.
I guess, you know, it's not always all about mental health. You know, I do go out on my padded walk. I do go out for walks. You know, I do have a great social life. And yeah, so like I said, it's important, I guess, to have a sense of humour about these things and to make sure that, you know, I do have fun because that's important as well. It's important to, you know, to try and find the joy in life, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Amen to that. Chris, should we do our quick fire questions with Stu?
Yeah, I think so.
These are 10 questions we ask every guest on Finding Our Way. Quick fire questions!
Okay, Stu, describe yourself in 3 words.
Passionate, compassionate, and determined.
Your favourite snack for taking on a big old expedition?
Beef jerky.
Best mountain memory?
Summiting Mount Katahdin in Maine, in the USA.
Bucket list destination?
Alaska.
How often do you get lost?
Every time I go shopping in Asda.
Are you funny? I think yes. See previous answer.
If you were an animal, what animal would you be?
I think a manta ray.
Oh, interesting.
Interesting.
I've always wanted to fly, and I love the ocean, and manta rays fly in the ocean, so it seems like beautiful as well.
One thing you always carry on the hill or on expedition?
Beef jerky.
What does walking expeditioning mean to you?
Serenity.
And lastly, Stu, we want more of you. Where do we go?
You can visit my charity website at www.changinghorizons.org.
Brilliant. And there you will find links to mental health first aid, to educational talks and courses that you can book onto as well.
Stu, thank you so much. I always love talking with you, and that's been really thought-provoking. And I'm going to take a lot away from this conversation today.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you so much, Stu. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a privilege and honour, so thank you very much.
And thank you, lovely listeners, for listening. Let's grow this thing. Subscribe so you don't miss an episode of Finding Our Way. You can share the podcast with friends and your networks, and please do let us know what you think. Use @teambmc on Instagram and Twitter, and the hashtag Finding Our Way.
See you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Finding Our Way is brought to you by the British Mountaineering Council and is proudly supported by Berghouse. It's produced and presented by Cress Allwood and me, Marianne O'Hotter. It's edited by Chris Stone, and the artwork was designed by Neil Arch. Follow us on your podcast app so you don't miss an episode, and join the conversation on social with the hashtag Finding Our Way.